Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
First dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? My dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
I heard all the way in America, I heard all the way in Indonesia that this fella talks too much. They say he's another Muhammad Ali. There's just one Muhammad Ali. And I want you to, whoever you are, you are not a fighter, and you don't take my job. I'm the talker. Now, Clough, I've had enough. Stop it.
Hello and welcome to Football Ramble Daily Book Club with me, Luke Moore.
Me, Kate Mason.
And me, Andy Brassel.
On today's episode, we're going to focus on one of the definitive accounts of old Big Ed himself, Brian Clough. It's Duncan Hamilton's Provided You Don't Kiss Me.
How do you react, though, when someone, you know, from your playing staff comes and says, boss, I think you're doing this wrongly?
Good. Well, I ask him which way he thinks it should be done. We get down to it, and then we talk about it for 20 minutes, and then we decide I was right.
Yes, that's right. Duncan Hamilton, in his role as football reporter for the Nottinghamshire Evening Post, covers Nottingham Forest for over 20 years from February 1977. In Provided You Don't Kiss Me, he delivers an intimate and revealing portrait of their charismatic and at times increasingly enigmatic manager, Brian Clough, back-to-back European Cup winner, dedicated Frank Sinatra fan and provocateur of the football world.
The two proprietors of our two national newspapers, the Daily Mirror and the Sun, are Murdoch and Maxwell. If I wanted to improve the standard of life in this country overnight, and somebody gave me a magic wand at Christmas, I would have them removed from this planet.
Robertson, the first time we've seen them attack them, and there's Francis! Well, that's what I wanted to see Robertson do! And Trevor Francis, the million-pound man, puts his name on the score sheet and returns a great deal of the cheque.
Now, before we get into this incredibly revealing study of actually quite a complicated man, and you heard some of his audio greatest hits there, grabbing the attention of the great Muhammad Ali, jousting with Don Revy on national TV, and what is a remarkable piece of television when you watch it back. I wanted to point out that I've never actually been involved in a proper book club before. And what I mean by that is I've never turned up at someone's house or to a library, got a glass of wine on the go and prepared myself for some red hot literary chat. Kate, is this a format you're familiar with? Because something tells me you do this kind of stuff all the time.
Well, I'm actually pretty offended, Luke, that you don't consider our extremely erudite conversations on the phone to be red hot literary chat. But we'll come back to that in a minute. I've never been in a book club either. I've made many attempts to join book clubs, but funnily enough, when I turned up at the place where the book club was supposed to be with the book all read, no one was ever there.
Oh, really? That might say more about your social skills than anything else then.
Well, I'm hoping you're going to be really kind to me. And as we're not in the same room at the moment, maybe that's why it's going to be
so fine. I'm actually quite surprised that you have, I mean, if I saw you, when I listen to you speak and I see you, and take this with a pinch of salt, don't get offended, I instantly think book club.
Yeah.
But you've not. Okay, fair enough. Well, listen, this is a good enough place to start. Andy, what about you? Have you ever partaken in a good old-fashioned chairs in a circle book debate over a bowl of mini cheddars?
I've not, although I've frequently dreamed of it since very much enjoying the two series of the long-forgotten Channel 4 series, The Book Group. Hopefully, none of us here are former footballers or have got out-of-control opiate habits. Although I do notice that there have been no mini cheddars provided.
No, and, you know, it's very difficult.
In some cases, lockdown is not an excuse, Luke.
We're recording remotely, as you well know, but also when we record back in the studio, I can go and get you a packet of mini cheddars, Andy, from the office canteen, but you and I both know how long that will take, and we haven't got that much studio time, so you're going to have to just get on with it, I'm afraid. Provide your own mini cheddars and perhaps invoice Football Ramble Daily for them at a later date. Here's hoping we grow into it then, I suppose. I think we've started in a really fascinating place. One of the most interesting characters in the history of football, for my money. Duncan Hamilton, with incredible access to him and his methods. Kate, what were your initial thoughts on this book, provided you don't kiss me?
Well, Duncan Hamilton's such a great writer, isn't he, Luke? And what I really enjoyed about this one is that most football fans probably think they know a little bit about Brian Clough. He's such an iconic character. It's a sort of caricature, I think, probably many people of our generation would have of him. I'm including you in that one, Andy. You know, he, of course, had this very sad descent into alcoholism. But you also remember him for these barbs he was constantly throwing out at people, and the way he had such an incredible turn of phrase. You know, he's a very witty guy as well as being quite rancorous. So what I really enjoyed about this one is how obviously Hamilton had this unbelievable access to Brian Clough for all of those years. And it's clear that he's a fan, right? But he manages to do what is such a difficult thing to do when writing about a character like this, and present something that's sympathetic and has perspective, but also shows the really dark side of Brian Clough, and manages to keep it from being either one thing, kind of angel or devil, when he's presenting it. And of course, also what you feel throughout the book is, you know what's coming, right? So there's this feeling of pathos about why couldn't he have made up with Peter Taylor? Why couldn't he have had a less difficult time in some of these relationships with some of these characters? He might have had a better life. But then he's also this like strange genius, and it's incredible to see him in action.
Hmm. Andy, would you go along with that?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think, as Kate says, that it's sufficiently layered, the book and Duncan Hamilton's perspective, to pay homage to the myth, but at the same time show you that what the man beneath it was. And I think he does very well to fully praise him for his best bits and his best achievements, yet not skip and gloss over some of the more challenging aspects of his behavior and of his relationships with people, which I think is quite difficult to do, especially when the subject is no longer with us. I mean, that can often lead to the edges being taken off a character. It sort of made me think a little bit of like my own relationships. Like for example, like when my mum died, for example, I remember my dad really quickly shutting down anything I said that might be seen as not praising her as a saint. And I found that quite difficult because, you know, my mum, like everyone else, was not a saint. And the imperfections are what make you warm to people. So I think that was something that was really beautiful about this book. The other thing I liked so much about it is, as well as it being based around one of the iconic characters of English football, you get a lot of Duncan Hamilton in it. It's almost Hunter S. Thompson-esque, I think. He feels like a full participant, and you get a sense of him growing as a sports writer and as a person throughout the beginning. I think the image when he arrives in Clough's office for the first time, and he's, you know, barely more than a child, he feels totally unprepared, and he's very open and honest about that. I think that sets it up beautifully.
Yeah, I was a tiny bit suspicious of that as well sometimes, you know, of writers making themselves too big a part of the story of the people that they're writing the biography about. But here it worked really, really well. And I think it was partly to do with the way that, because the way that Hamilton works as a writer, as all great writers do really, is that he takes the tiny little anecdotes and then he makes that represent a whole world of the character. So there's a really, really lovely bit where he talks about how he always used to bring a book to go on the bus because he used to get to travel with the team. And he says, whenever I bought the book, Clough would always borrow it and he'd never give it back. And that was just such a, I don't know.
He ended up buying two copies of each book, didn't he? He said.
Exactly right. And I love the idea of all of these. One of them was Ernest Hemingway, A Movable Feast, combined with A.S. Byatt, I think, was one of the other ones as well. And it's quite charming to think of Clough kind of potentially hoarding all of these like scrappy books.
One of them is a book on psychoanalysis by Sigmund Freud.
And yeah, he didn't get on with that though.
one page of that and says, no, that's not for me. That, but just to hone in on a couple of things you guys mentioned in your initial thoughts, and to give maybe a few of my own, I felt like, because it's not approached in a traditional linear way, this book, it's not a case of it starts in this at this time period and ends at this time period. It's a lot looser than that. And what Hamilton seems to have wanted to do is to focus on different aspects of Clough's life and his relationships and his achievements and his experiences, and kind of extrapolate those out across different chapters, giving you a different impression of each of the different sides of him, rather than saying this is what happened in chronological order. I think that to me feels like how he gets away with inserting himself into the story so much, because in some of those, I mean, Andy mentioned Hunter S. Thompson there, in some of those Gonzo type stories, it clearly is, it was so obviously just more about the author than it is the subject, and you can choose whether you enjoy that or not, of course, but that is clearly what it's about. Whereas with this, it doesn't feel at any point that Clough isn't front and center, and what Hamilton does is he uses his own relationship with Clough, which actually towards the end he starts to talk about him as a father figure and talk about how much he's learned from him and how much he's gained from his experiences with him, and compares that actually quite favorably with his own father. It becomes a much more rounded account, and there's clearly an arc to it as well. I mean, his Clough's initial success at the very top level that starts not long into Hamilton's tenure in 1978, stretching all the way through to the last thing he wins with Forrest, obviously in 1990, is mirrored in terms of his life outside the game as well, Clough's life, I mean, the breakdown of some of his key personal relationships, his sad descent into alcoholism, which Hamilton describes as the man taking the drink, turning into the drink, taking the man. It gives the story of a quite macabre symmetry, really. And I think one of the reviews of it called it painfully unvarnished, which I think is correct. And I applaud Hamilton actually for resisting his hagiographic tendencies, because he clearly likes and respects Clough a great deal. To deliver all sides of him in, as I say, like an unvarnished way.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, just in microcosm, talking about the relationships, the way that they break down. At the end of their relationship, the last time he sees him is when Clough wants to write a one-off column for the Evening Post after he's retired. And it was big money back then. You know, 500 quid for a column was big money to ask for. It sounds as though the Post didn't want it particularly. Hamilton's the one who has to go back and tell him that. And they never speak again. Yeah. After this massive years and years long relationship, that's it, you're out.
And I think that's it, isn't it? That's what makes it so real. The fact that it does have, in some cases, quite mundane detail. I think that's really, really important, rather than it just being a huge list of achievements. The fact that you know sometimes Clough doesn't really have anything to say, or they're just chatting nonsense about I guess the fact that they have a similar frame of reference. And I think he relates to Hamilton because his dad came from the Northeast and he was a miner and his dad was a miner, so there's some sort of working class clique between them. But some days, like, Clough is a bit hungover and a bit uninspired, and he's just, you know, drinking whiskey out of a tea mug. I think that is all quite important. You know, the sense that it's not all just swathes of magic. I think that helps to humanize him and makes it a proper portrait rather than just a party political broadcast for the Brian Clough party.
And that's really important, because what that then does is that obviously, just as you say, Andy, it humanizes him, but it also makes him a lot more relatable, because because clearly despite what he said about walking on the River Trent and all that kind of stuff, clearly this is a guy who wanted more than anything else really to be loved, respected and appreciated. And you get the impression that's what drove him throughout his entire career, really. But at the same time, he is completely like undiluted as a character. Like, there's a book about the great Syd Barrett, the original Pink Floyd guitarist and songwriter, who obviously died very young and had his problems with died a few years ago, but had his very difficult problems with mental illness throughout his life. And there's a book about him called A Very Irregular Head. And the author talks about how different people dilute themselves throughout their lives. And so their talent and so their energy and their drive go longer and longer. And Syd Barrett just didn't do that. He didn't dilute any part of himself. And it reminds me of Clough a bit. It feels like everything's was sort of on his terms, and that comes across when you think about the things like the grudges that he bore, like Kate was referencing there with the author himself, but also with Peter Taylor as well, who I don't think they had their relationship ever repaired before Peter Taylor sadly died. So
I think that's one of the things, isn't it, the sense of regret after Peter Taylor dies. He finds it very, very difficult to come to terms with, and that's a piece of Clough I think we're not used to seeing, that sort of vulnerability. And that is something that only the author, really, with his years of relationship with Brian Clough and his access behind the curtain, as Kate was saying, it's only him who can really bring that to us, because it's something that he finds very difficult to get over, and he gets really bogged down, you sense, in the regret that he was never able to make it up with Peter Taylor. And not just that, I think Clough's very self-critical, isn't he? He's very much, why didn't I take the opportunity to make it up? Why did I leave it so late? And that's something he finds very difficult to get away from.
That's one of the really endearing things, actually, about Clough in this book, is that he does seem to have quite a good capacity for self-analysis. So even though he does, some of these things that he does and some of the behaviours that you read about are just dreadful, basically. He just some of the bullying that I understand that it's from a different era and we're looking at it through a 2020 lens, but some of the stuff he does to people and the way he treats them just sounds really horrendous. But then later in the story, you sense that he does have an idea of what kind of a man he is. And that is something that he struggles with. The other thing that I really liked about what you were saying, Andy, about the relationship and seeing behind the curtain because of the privileged position that Duncan Hamilton has, is that perhaps from our perspective, it's pretty amazing to see a journalist have that level of access to a really, at that time, elite level club. What's he doing on the team bus? It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. but you did, going back to this idea of some of his behaviour, Kate, because I want to drill down on that a little bit more. I mean, it's a dichotomy there, isn't there? Because he's clearly lauded, and in my opinion, on balance, rightly so, as an amazing man manager. I mean, if you go and watch many of the interviews of players who've played under Clough, a lot of whom have gone on to become successful managers in their own right, and a lot of whom won the top trophies available in the game, they defend him to the hilt, really. I mean, I did a Ramble Meets with Trevor Francis not that long ago, who said that, you know, everything Clough did for a reason. And even if I didn't agree with it at the time, I understand why he did it and I respect it and I accept it. I mean, I came to that interview with Trevor pretty prepared to defend him and sympathize with him because of the way he had been treated at times by Brian Clough. And he just wouldn't have any of it. He was like, no, I accept it. I understand why it happened and why it needed to happen. And it helped me become successful. Yet on the other side of it, there are things, as you say, Kate, that through a 2020 lens are clearly problematic. I mean, the treatment of Justin Fashanu, the physical abuse he dished out to players, seemingly proud to do so as well. What's your takeaway from that? And do you just think that's just a further illustration of the, like I said, the dichotomy, the confliction in human beings?
Well, it's a symptom of a great manager, isn't it? That they can act in sometimes problematic ways, and the people that they serve, if you like, their players, will back them to the hilt and will perceive it to be all part of a grand plan. I mean, I don't know about you, but reading this, I did think on many occasions about Jose Mourinho and the career arc that he's had. And I know that I think Daniel Taylor's book on Clough, I think Mourinho wrote the foreword to it. So clearly he recognises that there is some level of this. This is what's so exciting to read about Brian Clough, though, is that he's this incredible, charismatic man who can make people behave in these, you know, play above themselves, achieve things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. But yet, you mentioned him not liking the Freud book. And he, in that passage, when Hamilton and he are discussing it, he says that he can read players, he can understand what they want, and he can effectively bend them to his will. And so it's quite painful reading the section about Justin Fashanu and about how he effectively didn't feel as though Justin Fashanu, who was gay and obviously was struggling with dealing with being in the spotlight and having such a hefty price tag placed on him at such a young age, and there's all this stuff about how he wore, you know, vibrant clothes and that sort of thing. I mean, yes, I appreciate we're talking about a different era, but it's just interesting to see that if some of these players were the kind of men that Clough was able to understand in perhaps a kind of carbon copy version of themselves, then that was okay. And he felt he could read them. But I think anything slightly away from that norm was very difficult for him.
And I think that's a problem that dogs football to this day now.
Generally, but Andy, yeah, that's but Andy, why it's so interesting.
What I got from that actually was not necessarily that Clough was a homophobe, although I think, you know, you could definitely deduce that from the way it went down. But I think that the interesting thing is that he seemed to me less inclined to, from the way that Hamilton told it, to help Justin Fashanu, not because he was homophobic, but because he was Peter Taylor's signing and he never agreed with the signing in the first place. So it felt to me like a simple matter of ego. And I think that's a really interesting thing at the heart of at the heart of Clough, and certainly at the heart of the way Clough is presented in this book. The fact that he's someone who he knows, as Kate says, that he's got this ability to relate to people. It's said again and again and again by Hamilton, the fact that Clough has no real interest in tactics. He has no interest in training most days. And that's why him and Taylor work so well together, because he could just leave Peter Taylor to get on with it. And then he'd just, you know, enigmatically show up, whether it be the day before the game or whether it be, you know, 45 minutes before kickoff to tell everyone what the team was. But I think that's the really interesting way about the way Clough is looked at here. You're almost allowed to draw your own conclusions, I think, rather than Hamilton saying, right, okay, I followed him for 12 years, 14 years, whatever it is, therefore I know everything about him. What he does is he puts it all out there and you're allowed to maybe draw your own conclusion. I mean, you talked about the physical violence before, and the bit that really struck me in the book is the bit where he's talking about when Clough comes on the pitch and clips a couple of pitch invaders around the ear after they beat Queen's Park Rangers in the League Cup. I remember this quite vividly from the time, being ever so slightly older than you guys. And at the time, Cloughy was celebrated as good old Cloughy, not putting up with these yobbos, etc., etc. Yet the way that Hamilton presents it is he was just drunk and, you know, didn't think about it. I don't think there was, from his perspective, there's no stand there. There's no sense of, right, this is me doing the right thing. He's just a bit drunk and not having it.
Okay, well, that's it for part one, but stick around because after the break, we'll delve more into Clough's charm and charisma and discuss some of the darker sides of his personality as reported by the author.
Good. Just sorry about it. Apologise to your mum and dad.
Yeah, my dad's ashamed of me as well.
Good. Okay. Now, what's important, lads, is anybody can apologise, because I've done it. I've apologised for becoming physically involved with you. The important thing is not to do it again. Now, I won't do it again, and you won't.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
How can you be bottom of the Premier League?
Well, to be fair, it's kept me awake for about 4 or 5 nights in the last 3 months, every week. And I don't know how we're bottom of the Premier League, but we are bottom. You've got to be realistic. We are bottom of the Premier League. It's as simple as that. And until we get away from the bottom, Raymond, people like you will continually and perpetually, and whatever the words are, will keep asking me these questions. But we've got to get away from the bottom of that league. I am sick of being bottom of that league.
Hamilton's portrayal of Clough's descent into alcoholism is kind of there in front and centre, really, certainly towards the second half of the book. Hamilton later said he felt ashamed of his part in what he considered to be enabling Clough's illness. And there's a version of the book I've got, it's a Q&A with the author at the end, and he sort of confirms that. What did you take away from that aspect and that theme from within the book? Did you think that Hamilton was harsh on himself to say that later, or purely because even in this style of writing, it's not really the author's job to interfere necessarily, is it? But on the same token, that could be seen as a bit of a cop out. I remember there's a is it the Tom Wolfe book, the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, where he witnesses a lot of appalling behaviour during the writing of that, and he makes a decision not to interfere because he thinks that, you know, I'm essentially a documentary writer here and I can't really interfere with the natural order of things.
And I do think it goes back, Luke, to the Ramble Meets you did recently, actually, with James Montagu, where
it's another good example. Yeah,
he said how you know to fully chronicle a behavior and a behavior that you don't agree with, you've got to like park your judgment for a minute and just let it happen, which is very difficult, I think, for a journalist. But I think as well, it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning with Duncan Hamilton in particular. There's a couple of elements. Firstly, if he'd not have sat down in Brian Clough's office and had a drink with him and always said, oh no, I'll just have a water, or can you get me a cup of tea? Maybe Clough wouldn't have opened up to him in the first place. Maybe Clough would have felt judged. I think the other thing you have to bear in mind is the comparative authority of the two figures in this book. So whereas by the time that he's writing this book for us, he's someone who I think is acutely aware of the pitfalls of journalism and sports journalism. I think that's clear. He's pretty clear and authoritative in terms of cliches around Clough himself. But when you go back to the beginning, he's just a kid. He's just a kid there in the office of this incredibly famous football manager. And is he going to say no to a drink? It's almost like breaking cover. And there's going to be no trust there in the beginning. So I don't think you can really... I think he's very harsh to judge himself on that.
Yeah, I mean, Kate, I'll bring you in just a second, but just to follow up on that before I do, it's a piece in the Daily Telegraph written by Jim White, who says, in his life, Clough was protected from exposure by the frightened silence of those around him. Hamilton is clearly ashamed of his part in the conspiracy, to which Duncan Hamilton said, he's right, I am, but even now, I'm not sure whether or not my voice railing against it, or anyone else's for that matter, could have kept Brian away from alcohol. How do you react to that, Kate?
Well, it's an illness, alcoholism. Yeah. And the difficult thing, the reason why it's so complex in this presentation, in a book like this, is because, as so often throughout history and throughout literature, alcohol is associated with, you know, being a bon vivant, and this whole idea of him bringing you into his office and offering you a scotch and this bonhomie and having a chat. It's what you're talking about. It's this ability to create a sense of collaboration, and this is perhaps a little bit off the record, and we're chatting outside of normal life if we've got alcohol. So, well, it seems as though it's very difficult to split the two things. It's clear that Brian Clough had an illness, and of course we don't know anything about what his life would have been like if he'd had support to help him exist without alcohol. But it's part of the tragedy, isn't it, that people, I think, accept that alcohol was part of how he functioned. So, yeah, perhaps that's a bit of a limp answer, but I don't, you know, you would hope that today an employee of a company, which is, let's not forget what he was, would be given a bit more help to deal with something that was beyond his control.
Kate, it's part of this. Sorry, Kate, I was going to say, it's part of this, the fact that it's Nottingham Forest. I mean, like, I think it's brought home to us again and again in the book that he's able to let his dictatorial side flourish because it's little old Forrest who had no real big guy at the top of the club pumping all the money in, who just had members who chipped a little bit in. It was almost like a sporting society rather than the ownership model of a lot of other their rivals in the first division. And like Clough was the only real sporting authority at the club apart from Peter Taylor, really. So for that reason, he gets to run the club in a way that he could never run any other club. And, you know, they talk about England being scared to give him the job, or bigger clubs like Liverpool or Arsenal being scared to give him the job because, you know, he's this firebrand. But actually, he never really wanted that, did he? Because he wanted to run the club according to the gospel of Cloughy. He didn't want to be told what to do by anyone else. And you always have the sense that he wouldn't have accepted that.
Well, that's for absolutely sure, but the case. Yeah, absolutely.
It just seems as though, you know, just to keep coming, I know this is not like this is quite a boring point in the context. We're talking about the character of this man, which is so extreme and dramatic and exciting to be around, and people are carried along with it. And then we're saying, well, but he was an alcoholic, and some of the stuff he is drinking, it's like extraordinary that he is able to function at all, to do anything, let alone run an entire football club. But that's an aside. But again and again, I just return to the fact, and I think that's the point that Duncan Hamilton is trying to make, that this was an open secret, that he could not, he did need help. This man needed help. And whether or not he's a, yes, I'm sure he made it difficult for people to help him by virtue of the force of his personality. You just wonder what would have been different if someone had been able to help him. Because, you know, this is classic alcoholism, isn't it? Not seeking help, not wanting to change. That's the first stage of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? You know, I accept that I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah, but I mean, that it's clearly a theme that runs throughout the book, particularly in the sort of latter half of it. But I mean, just changing tack ever so slightly away from that aspect of his character, the charisma of the man and the sheer force of personality that he, I mean, the author talks a lot about Clough just being able to walk into a room, and just things like the very idea that everyone knew that Clough had turned up at the training ground, or had arrived at the stadium, or had walked into the room of a hotel bar or whatever. And everyone who knew him, and in some cases, people that didn't know him's behavior just instantly changing. That kind of magnetism is, and Kate, earlier you mentioned Jose Mourinho, is clearly there's a comparison to be drawn there. That kind of magnetism is fascinating to me, chiefly because I would have loved to have been able to experience meeting him and spending some time with him if I was able. But also, it's a part of football that we can't sort of quantify or explain. And in this modern need to justify everything with data or with insight or with statistics or whatever it may be. There's a certain X factor about high achievers in whatever field they're in that I think other human beings find very hard to quantify. And I think that really comes across sort of loud and clear in this portrayal of Clough, doesn't it?
Yeah, charm's one of your favourite things, isn't it, Luke? I think it's fair to say.
I'd quite like to experience it. Yeah, I've heard rumours of its existence.
Yeah, I mean that's I suppose why he's such a ripe topic for a book like this, and for so many books, of course, you know, Damned United, etc.
But this one's set apart, Kate, isn't it? Because this is a definitive account from the time. It's a contemporaneous account when compared to this is not meant to be to the detriment of Jonathan Wilson's book on him, obviously, also of this parish, or David Peace's slightly different take on it, or Daniel Taylor's take. This is the contemporaneous account, which for me makes it the most powerful, and I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Well, I wouldn't want to start ranking them. Ruthless.
Well, that's the last section of the show.
I'm United at some point.
But you know, it's a fascinating part of it, right? And that's the whole point of the book almost. If he was the most boring guy around and he won a couple of European Cups back to back and achieved everything he achieved, I'm sure it would still be a fine story and people would enjoy reading about it. But the aspect that I'm trying to zero in on here is the idea that the character he was makes this such an important and interesting story, right?
Yeah, of course. And the way that you never know how he's going to react next. There's a lot of stuff about how he tries to keep his players on their toes, but also some of the loveliest descriptions are of his generosity. People finding their wedding reception paid for in one notable instance.
Yeah. Is that because he wanted to be liked, though, again?
I think so. I mean, there's another section as well where Hamilton writes about how he... You mentioned, of course, Luke, that most of the time people are aware when he turns up and are kind of, you know, are drawn towards this magnetic force that is Brian Clough. But there's also a section more towards the end where he says that if people didn't pick up on who it was, he might start having a loud conversation with the barman who's 20 feet away in order that people do realise who they're drinking with.
Andy, did you like him?
Yeah, I did. I really did. And when you talk about like his outbursts of generosity, that scene in the Brighton hotel lobby notwithstanding, it's generally quite anonymous, isn't it? Which I think is quite interesting, that he does it simply because he thinks it's a nice thing to do rather than for the publicity. And for someone that we're aware of throughout the book is acutely aware of the value of publicity and the value of self-publicity, that doesn't really factor into that. I think in terms of his chops in the game, blowing his own trumpet is very, very important. And I do wonder as well, you know, when you, I think you can't help when you're reading the book, sort of place him into the hierarchy of great English and British and British-based coaches as well. And the Mourinho point that Kate made is a really interesting one. I wonder if without Clough, there is the appetite for Mourinho in the first place, because someone who is so totally contemptuous of people's technical questions on the sport, and that really as fans is what a lot of us want to know: what really happens on the training ground, how does the team actually function for those of us who've never coached a team, whereas Clough is really the first in sort of creating this mystique around the manager. And I think of modern managers or head coaches, no one like Mourinho is so keen to keep that mystique alive. But I think it's so curious, isn't it, that because Clough remains thoroughly charming, despite the fact that he is clearly quite self-aggrandizing, I just wonder if sometimes you need that historical perspective to be able to absorb it all. Because when I think back to the first couple of times I spoke to Mourinho when he was still in charge of Porto, I think now, looking at it in 2020, you can totally forget how charming Jose Mourinho used to be. He really was, you know, he was smart, he was dashing, he was witty. And as time goes by and, you know, that feeling of power starts to slip away, is that the bit where you become a bit more barbed and henceforth a bit more difficult to like?
I think it's a well-worn, it's a really good observation. I think it's a well-worn trope, isn't it? I mean, people just get naturally, or in some cases, particularly in the cases of high-achieving people in really popular industries, you always get a new generation that comes along behind with yet more ideas, yet more innovation, and an increased ability to relate to the younger audience or the younger player, whatever it may be. Mourinho said himself, he finds it harder and harder to relate to younger players. He was using it. The example he was using was Marcus Rashford when he was at United. I like Marcus Rashford because he reminds me of an older player. I find it hard to relate to the younger players now. There's always going to be a timeline. You're always on that treadmill. Mm. And it happened with Clough as well. Like, Hamilton's very, very scathing in some instances about a man who he clearly likes. I mean, it's a very touching moment in the book when Hamilton finds out that Clough has died. And we mentioned it at the very start of this father figure type mentality. But he's also, at the same time, very scathing and very damning and very dismissive of the idea that Clough would ever be successful as a coach or a manager in 2007, 2008, when the book was written. This wouldn't be possible. He would have been a person out of time because of the demands are different, because the standards are different. And because of that thing you mentioned, Andy, around the size of the club that he managed that and all the rest of it. So what happens is we see with these big charismatic characters, and Hamilton also says, by the way, that a lot of Clough's charm was superficial, and he was almost certain that he was an actor performing a role, and he would practice all these amazing lines that he's now known for way in advance, and he would just perform them rather than think of them spontaneously. But there is also an element, always, I think, of a bitterness that starts to creep in. And perhaps in Clough's case, it was accelerated by his use of alcohol and the trouble he got himself in. But I do think that it's not a coincidence that these types, Mourinho, Clough, whoever they may be, do start to come with an undercurrent of bitterness that is actually quite prevalent in whole generations of men when they get to a certain age. I know that's a really sweeping thing to say, but I do think there's an element of that in large swathes of the male population at a certain age. And these guys are just a very crystallized version of that.
One of the key things that made me think of Mourinho, apart from the obvious trajectory and the various charm elements, was towards the end, actually, when Hamilton said, "Phrase making fascinated Clough, the way a piece of writing took shape in the mind before it assumed permanent form on paper." Now, you say, Luke, of course, that he practiced and acted out delivering lines. But one of the reasons why this book is so successful, I think, is that it's clear that Clough respects and recognizes the force of writing and the force of delivering key points in an interesting way as a real important element of the job that he was trying to do. And then he respected Duncan Hamilton's ability to do that in his area of life. And so I think he had a real grasp of what journalism was and what it was for. And so I think they felt an affinity there. And it cuts to the heart of the way his charm was performed, I think, the ability to speak in an interesting way.
Yeah, I agree. I think the end, there's an epilogue as well in my version of the book where he talks a bit more about Brian Clough's sad passing. But the end of the book, the copy I've got, Hamilton finishes by quoting Red Smith, the great writer. He says, "Dying is no big deal," Red Smith wrote. "The least of us will manage that, but living's the trick." Brian Clough lived and he lives still. I thought that was a tremendously powerful way to end the book.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, the epilogue is brilliant.
Because
after all of this, you've had this nuanced picture created throughout. And then at the end, I don't know, I was quite close to tears, to be honest.
It's a very human reaction, isn't it, at the end?
I didn't necessarily like him throughout because just personally, one of my things that I really admire in managers and people who are looking after people is consistency. And so it sounds as though Brian Clough would not have been in my good books. But at the end, the human moment of him assessing what kind of a guy he was and Duncan Hamilton experiencing the loss. Oh, it's breathtaking.
Okay, that's just about all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much to you, Kate Mason.
Thanks, Luke. That was great.
And thank you, as ever, Andy Brassel.
Thank you so much.
And that was Provided You Don't Kiss Me, the inaugural selection of the brand new Football Ramble Daily Book Club. Why not let us know what you thought of the book
or suggest future selections we can talk about over on our social media accounts at Football Ramble on Twitter and at Football Ramble Daily on Instagram. And of course, if you want to sign up to our Patreon to get extra insight, bonus shows and plenty more besides for as little as $5 a month, it's patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to talking with you next time.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.